people might have questions. Yes.
I'd like what you say, of course, about one's intent, looking at oneself and one's motivation. But I somehow have difficulty reconciling the word compassion and the way in which it's sort of been described to me with the excuse for not taking any action. The things that are available to us to make change are to protest, are to vote, are to speak out. So personally, I can look at what my motivation is, but I'm often surrounded by people who are angry about the injustice.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, from the point of view of group karma, how that plays out and how one reconciles, you know, both emotions, and whether, even though I've been told by other lamas, it's never good to be angry, it's never good to be angry,
It's never good to be angry, exactly, yeah.
Anger motivates people to make change.
Yes, but that... You see, this is what we spoke a little bit about on Friday night, that there is what seems like the seeming temporary, the temporary seeming benefit, and then there's the long-term results. And because we are still in samsara, we will always have injustice. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try to fix injustice. It doesn't mean we shouldn't try to bring people happiness. But we have to recognize there is always going to be injustice. If we fix racism against black people and overcome it entirely, then we are going to have racism against green people. It's just how it works.
I get that, but how do we make change in a way that does not promote anger and at the same time recognizes that we should not step back and not engage?
Well, take a look at the example of Gandhi, who, though not a Buddhist, was a very strong practitioner. He did a lot of meditation. He had developed a very strong meditation, and he got to the point where he had overcome the afflictions of this world and was able to lead an incredible movement that brought India to independence. Now, most of the people in the movement were not on the level that he did, and as a result, he was killed by the Shiv Sena, and then there was the partition where hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered in ethnic cleansing. And yet, he did what he could. So, I think if we look at an example of what we can do, then we look at that example. Another example might be the example of Martin Luther King. Though I don't know as much about the level of his practice, he certainly took the Christian teachings at heart and used them as an idea, as a way of needing to bring justice and justice for African Americans. And he did a lot for that, nonviolently. So when we do this, we have to find that we're acting. I think that if we can find action where we are acting non-violently on the outside and non-violently on the inside both, then that, I think, is going to be good social activity that is going to benefit everyone. But it won't be easy, and there will be people who will stop it, and people who engage in this activity will probably be harmed and killed and so forth and get plenty of opportunity to practice patience because we are in samsara. Even if we succeed now in having social movements that create prosperity and happiness for all sentient beings, because we are in samsara, it will be impermanent. And then another era will come and it'll be rotten again. This is the nature of samsara. This is why we have to achieve liberation from samsara. And so then you have to think to yourself, well, what is going to be the most effective way to benefit beings? should I work my butt off now to bring temporary happiness in this society? Or should I work my butt off now to gain Buddhahood? I mean, that's the, I mean, because when you bring, when someone is brought to the state of Buddhahood, when someone is brought to the state of realization, forget about Buddhahood, just the first stages of realization, they're freed from suffering. Not that they're freed from the situations around them, but they no longer occur to them, appear to them as suffering. And so they're able to bear with so much that we can't. As I read yesterday from the description of the different types of patience of the Bodhisattva, when you realize that everything is like space, then you will not strike back when struck. You will not talk back when insulted. You will not criticize when criticized, because you understand the nature of everything as being empty and insubstantial. When you really have that, and so if we can ourselves achieve that state and help others get to that point, then those beings we help to get to that state of even that first state of realization are freed from a lot of suffering. And they themselves will be able to bring the same benefit to other sentient beings. So what is a greater benefit? One is what we all say in the society is the great benefit. Yes, the society is happy. The historians will write about it 1,000 years from now if they're not drowned by rising ocean levels. They'll write about it 1,000 years from now, and they'll say, yes, society was good for 50 or 60 years, and then look what happened. So that's, you know, our way of looking at it. The nature of samsara is that it is not right. It doesn't work out. Yes?
I wanted to request the one for the bodhichara avichara, and I wondered if we could not get one for, if we couldn't get the whole text, what we've done up till now, and if we couldn't do that for this chapter.
Well, let's see. Well, that's an interesting question, because I'm not sure I have the Tibetan on me, for one thing, and I'm very slow at reading. And then the issue, is there a transmission in English? Yeah, it's a very interesting one. I have to talk to the Karmapa. Please tell me what is going on. When do we start having a transmission in English? Generally what happens, if this were an instruction given in Tibetan, then you would have already received the lung up to the point that we've got to. The lung means a reading transmission. It's when you receive, when you hear the teachings, and then there's a transmission that comes from it. It comes from the way texts were originally taught. And a senior monk or nun would teach it to a junior monk or nun who would then memorize it, because for the first several hundred years of Buddhism, there was nothing was written down. So everything was passed down completely orally. So that oral transmission is then still considered very important, even though we now rely on writing and even now electronic writing. If, for example, Kenpo Jigme were teaching this in Tibetan, or some other teacher were teaching in Tibetan, you would have the lung, the transmission, up to this point. And since we're teaching it in English, I don't know. I don't want to say, yes, there is a transmission, that would be too much. Probably not, but I need to check on that. For me to give the lung in Tibetan, because my reading is very slow, would take a while. We'd have to plan that separately. We don't have time to do it this afternoon, unfortunately. But we can think about that. And if I get a chance to see His Holiness, I might ask him that question. I might ask Rinpoche that question. Thank you, though. Yes?
When you speak about having precious human birth and then the teachings available, you know, they often use the word, you know, have incredible good fortune. Is that just another way of saying karma, or something else?
Yeah, it's saying karma. But when you think about it, the karma that puts us in this position is incredibly uncommon, incredibly rare. Just look at this earth. I mean, we went over this a few years ago. looking at that. Were you at the class where we were talking about the precious human birth, and I brought out the figures I got from Google, 250 sextillion animals in the world, and only 500 million Buddhists, therefore you have a 1 in 40 billion chance of being born Buddhist. You might have a better chance of winning the main lottery 5 times in a row. Wasting $5 on the tickets. So that karma is so rare. Of course, it does come out of causes and conditions. Fortune does not mean that it's some magical thing that a fairy, you know, waved a wand and all of a sudden you got to be human. The fortune means that you actually did something good in a past life that led to this. And it ripened. All the causes and conditions came together that you're here, and this is just so rare. It's rarer than seeing a star in the middle of the day. And that's just incredible. It's like this chance that we've got that if we mess up, we're not going to see this again, which doesn't mean literally not ever see it again, because we'll have an infinite number of lifetimes ahead of us, but it's going to take a really long time. So now that we have that chance, we use it well. And if we use it well, then we're kind of hedging our bets. We're, you know, karmic cause and effect, when you realize it, it actually gives you a lot of freedom. Karma actually means that you have control, because you can control what you do. And in order to control that, you have to control your mind. And then the more good that you do, the less bad you do, and even best is to do nothing bad at all. Then you've got a fighting chance of being in a good position next time around. Yeah?
For instance, like alcoholics, I'm a recovering alcoholic, so like at my very bottom, depressed, suicide attempts, all that, somehow I woke up.
Yeah.
And I ran into trouble in the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
But does that mean other people, if they're suffering, just say from alcoholism and addiction, if it's not karmically, they're just never going to, there's no chance for them? Or how do you look at that?
Oh, there's a chance for them. There's a chance for everyone, because everyone has Buddha nature. So what happened for you is we have what we call in the Dharma, we call them the imprints of listening. This means that you heard about the Dharma, you heard a teaching or something sometime way in the past. And because we've had an infinite set of lifetimes, we've all heard about the Dharma at some time in the past. Now, a lot of people, they hear about the Dharma, and a lot of people hear about the Dharma, and they say, oh yeah, there's Buddhism, and then they go off on their merry way. It doesn't make an impression on them right now. But that's an imprint of listening. So sometime in the past, you had that imprint of listening, and then something came together. You had the compassion of the guru. You were in just the right situation. That imprint of listening ripened, and as a result, you're with us here today. And so anyone has it. No matter how deep in the misery of addiction they are, they have that somewhere in there. Whether it can waken or not in this lifetime is a very good question. And we, of course, have to do what we can to try to help them, understanding, however, that it really depends upon them and their karma and their situation. So when we have these people and we try to help people, we also have to kind of have a little bit of a detachment and not expecting any particular result. Because when you're expecting a result out of someone else, you're kind of imposing your idea on them. Especially for people who are in difficult positions, you have to let them make their own way. Otherwise, they're going to kind of push against. It won't work. Yeah. So.
You mentioned earlier about karma in certain situations, and when events occur completely out of our control. Someone dies, there's a big earthquake, there's a devastating event that completely shatters our world. like one day things are going okay, and the next day everything is completely different.
Yeah.
Is that a result of our karma, or is that circumstance?
That's probably a result of karma, I think. I'm having been through one in Nepal in 2015.
Would you say that even death, someone's sudden death?
Well, that's going to depend upon the causes of that particular death. I mean, it's hard to say in particular. It could well be, for example, if someone is born with a congenital heart condition that they don't know. This is the example I always say. So if you've heard me say this one before, someone is born with a congenital heart condition that no one detects until they get to the age of 47 and 3 months, and then they keel over dead because of that congenital heart condition. That's got to be full ripening of karma. If that person doesn't have a congenital heart condition, but on their 47th birthday or their 47th and 3 month anniversary of their birth, if I'm going to use the same, gets drunk and trips and falls off a roof and dies, that's may well not become karma because they got drunk and fell off the roof, right? So it's hard to tell. Now, it could be that it was something karmic that made them drink, and there's some sort of indirect result, but it is so difficult to say, this is karma, this is not karma. But there are certain things that you can say pretty definitively are karma. Being in Nepal during the earthquake in 2015, well, for me, it was a choice. But for the people, for the Nepalis, it was not. It was where they were born. Having the congenital heart defect or congenital other disease is not. If you are born into a place and you live there and as a result get some environmental condition gives you cancer, that could well be the result of karma. So it's difficult to really, we can't say 100% one, 100% the other. But there are certain conditions, certain things like that we probably say probably are results of karma. Mm-hmm, sure.
The person passes away very suddenly. The people left, family, friends, who are all so, devastated by the event. What about them? What about the people that are the family? Is this happening to them as a result of their personal karma or circumstance?
Probably their connection to that person is a result of karma if they're born into the same family. Their reaction, however, is kind of up to them. Within limits, because some people are so overcome by grief that they fall into deep depression. And that might be from various factors. Some people grieve and feel bad, but they get on with things. So people have different reactions. So their particular reaction is also a result of their character. Their character comes to a certain amount because of conditioning from the past lives. It comes about from what they do in this lifetime. And there's a little bit of control, but not a whole lot. So some people, if they end up being completely in a rage because their loved one died, they're just getting angry. So that's hard to say. You can't condemn someone for that because that's their reaction. Do I sound heartless today? Shiristan, you look like you've got something to say.
Well, I'm just thinking, I think you've spoken about this in the past, we talked about karma, but I'm just thinking about how do we think of or sort out the difference between collective karma and individual karma?
Okay, collective karma versus individual karma. The general appearances of the world that seem common to all of us. The ocean is wet, the ground is dry, there are houses here in Portland, the geography is like this, and we can all talk about trees as being the same way, and that we're all born at the same time, we're enjoying the certain position in a prosperous society, whatever that position, now we might be on the more prosperous end or the less prosperous end, but we're enjoying some position in a prosperous society. That is our collective karma. the fact that you in particular were born in a particular family in a particular place is a result of karma. So, for example, the karma that led me to be born to my particular father and mother in North Adams, Massachusetts in 1967 is my, that was because of my karma. The fact that other beings were also born in that same time and place is their karma. Our common perceptions of North Adams and Williamstown, that area, is like our collective karma. Yes, Tracy.
What do you see as the benefit to attempting to figure out what is a ripened karma and what is just circumstance? For instance, my house gets struck by lightning and burns to the ground. That could be karmic ripening. It could just be happenstance. What difference really, how does it help me to consider it one or the other since I have no way of knowing?
Well, we have no way of knowing. What we have to do is, at the beginning, we have to use our logic. Now, trying to figure out why a specific instance happened is just a way to give yourself a headache.
Sure.
Frankly. I mean, there are certain things that are probably pretty clearly karma, certain things that are pretty clearly the person just doing something stupid, and certain things that are way in the gray area and you just can't tell. So what's most important is to kind of think about the teachings as given, to study them. They're taught in the Abhidharma and so forth, and kind of learn the general way things work, and then look and see what's happening in your own mind now. How it works, what is it like when you do something, how does it ripen, what's coming out, what could have been, why is it that you managed to get to this point, like your question about how you got to be, how is it that we got to meet Rinpoche, how is it that I, at the time that I was ready for it, I met Rinpoche. This is the same for many of us in this room. So what brought about that? Thinking about that, that's a good thing. Really what's important, the only way we can understand karma is by coming to understand interdependence. How things happen because of causes and conditions. Everything is related in this big web of causes and conditions. And so when we begin to understand how those causes and conditions work, then we're going to be able to see how karmic cause and effect work. So the greater understanding of interdependence we have, the greater our understanding of karmic cause and effect is. And we'll also have a greater understanding of emptiness. And so then the more we understand this, then we get to the point where we meditate, we have conceptual understanding, and our certainty grows stronger, and then we can come to a point where we have realization, and then we can begin to actually perceive things. Or we can also develop the powers of our meditation. When you develop enough shamatha, it is said that you will be able to remember some of your past lives. So if we really get good shamatha meditation, you'll be able to remember past lives. Now, though I say this, I have to caution that in our Mahamudra tradition, we do not emphasize this. It's like, you remember your past lives, you don't remember your past lives, fine. We're going to look at the nature of our mind. So it's better when you're practicing shamatha meditation to just try to develop the stability of mind and not think, oh, if I get strong enough shamatha meditation, I can remember what I was in my past life. Maybe I was Eleanor of Akaten. I don't know. More like you're going to remember, oh, I was a squid. Well, perhaps that's enough for this afternoon. And so at this point, I would like to thank all of you for coming. Those of you I have known for many years, those of you whom I am just coming to know now, I'm glad to either see you again or to meet you anew this year. And I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to come again to Portland for what is feeling like a very short visit, as I fly to Nepal tonight. So it just feels like a very short time to be here. But I'm glad for the opportunity that I have. And also, frankly, I've said this, I think before, my opportunity to do this is because of you. I wouldn't have... If Rinpoche did not need a translator for people who didn't speak Tibetan, he never would have plucked me out of North America and brought me to Nepal. And then I wouldn't have this... I'd have to have a job. How dreadful. But no, it's really because of all of you that I'm able to be here and do this, and particularly the main sangha, because of this is it was in Maine that Rinpoche, you know, asked me to come. So there's a real connection. The first time I met Rinpoche was at the famed tent retreat in 1998. So I met it in Maine, and that's when I also met several of you. And then I met others of you at other retreats of Rinpoche's, and now we're getting to know other people now. So this opportunity that I have to spend my life doing something that at least is beneficial for me, and I hope is beneficial for others, is really only because of people such as yourself. Also because of the people, of course, the people in Vancouver and Hong Kong and all the other places I go, all the people who come to listen to translations at Kajumunlam or wherever I have to do this. And if it weren't for all of you, all of the people, and so I feel incredibly grateful to every one of you so I'd just like to take this opportunity to really thank all of you for that. In particular, I would like to I know several of you have worked a fair amount on the organization, and the interface has primarily been with, before I came, it was primarily through Steve, and it was, since I've been here, it's been Peter who's been hosting me and helping out. But I can gather from what they have said that there have been several of you involved in different aspects. You've all worked hard, and you've done a good job of bringing me here and hosting a weekend that I have found helpful for myself, if it's not helpful for you. So I'd like to thank all of the organizers for all of your help doing this, even if I don't know exactly. I know that Ted and Susie had something going on, and I don't know who else was involved, because Kay was involved. Everyone, I'm going to miss, if I try to say all your names, I'm going to miss someone. So I will just give a general thank you. Actually, my kind of general policy is to kind of ignore the details because I don't really need to know. I'm trying to operate on a need-to-know basis. So I kind of purposely don't figure out who's doing it, but that doesn't mean that I'm not grateful to all of you who made even the smallest effort, such as lifting a single cushion. I am grateful for your help. Most of all, I'm grateful for your coming and being interested in the Dharma and doing what you can to help to study the Dharma and to help keep the Dharma teachings going here in Portland, Maine. This is an important service for a lot of people. And when we're in Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, in a fairly traditional place like the center like this, I don't think we're ever going to get the kind of mass participation. And I'm not sure that we need it. We need a few people, touch a few people, have a few people take it to heart, and really do the practice. So if you take these teachings that we're talking about, and you put them into practice, and you do something that brings benefit, that is the best way for you not only to benefit yourself, but also to repay the kindness of people like Trungpa Rinpoche, who came to Maine for many years until he just got too old to keep traveling as much, and to all the other masters and people who've worked so hard for the lineage. And I don't look at myself as being particularly kind to anyone. I try to do a little bit, but I don't have any qualities. Really, when I look out and I see all of you paying attention and thinking and listening, and when I hear you talking informally, when we're not in this about what you're doing and you're studying, I'm just delighted that you are taking this interest in Buddhism, and that for me is a great joy. So my life is really quite wonderful because of people like you. Thank you very much.